Harness, chaplain at the University of Maryland Medical Center, to represent the Christian perspective. They will each have some comments that they'll discuss related to the various issues specific to each of their faiths, and hopefully we'll have opportunity for interaction after their comments. So, David, would you like to start?
David, you go ahead, please.
Good to be with all of you. I'm honored to be a part of this group and to have been a part of this event. I thank Dr. Zinn and Rabbi Silber and the planning committee and all of you for the many contributions you've made to the rich discussion that we've had today around these issues. Whenever I'm called to see a patient in her 30s or later or earlier, or when I'm with the parents of a child with a very bad prognosis, I feel both a sense of humility and of courage. It's a humbling thing to enter into that space with a patient and with a family, but it's very necessary and important, and so courage is also part of that equation. I likewise feel that combination when it comes to talking about theology, because I am a mortal, and my ability to grasp the divine or things that are eternal is very limited. So I also feel a great deal of humility and modesty in talking about matters of theology, but also courage, because there is hope and possibility within the conversation. And likewise, I feel those same two realities as I think about this assignment, as I've been thinking about this assignment, both a sense of humility to speak for all of Christendom, if you will, and also a sense of courage, because this is an important conversation, and it's important for us to understand each other and where we come from and where our beliefs fit into our decisions related to healthcare. So I'm here to talk from a Christian perspective, and to do so, I want to focus on Jesus, which is a good place to start if you're a Christian. He was referenced earlier today, so he's already kind of been in the conversation. So I want to do a couple of things. First of all, I want to talk about Jesus, kind of give a basic understanding of what Christians believe about Jesus, and kind of the core concepts of the Christian faith. And then I want to get into, pull out some key pieces of that and how they enter into the conversation and enter into the reality when it comes to patients who are sick and who are dealing with end-of-life issues. So, again, to understand a Christian perspective, we have to know something about Jesus and what we believe about him. The Christian faith centers around Jesus, who was a first century Palestinian Jew who was born into a peasant class and became an influential, even transformational teacher and healer. His story is told in a series of books called Gospels, four of which form the core of our scriptures. Because he was rooted in the Jewish faith, Christians also consider the Hebrew scriptures to be part of our sacred text. The four Gospels tell how Jesus quickly developed a following, came to be seen as a threat to the establishment, and was publicly executed by the Roman authorities in a practice known as crucifixion. It involves fairly gruesome nailing to a cross. They also report how he arose from the grave, appeared to his disciples, and ascended into heaven, promising to eventually return. His disciples then continued Jesus' ministry and proclaimed him to be the Christ, or the Messiah, the fulfillment of Jewish prophecy. They also proclaimed his death and resurrection to be redemptive, the means by which we can be delivered from sin and death. Soon these followers of Jesus came to be known as Christians, which is another way of saying little Christ or Christ followers. So for Christians, Jesus is our authority and our example. Maybe you've heard of those little bracelets that have been popular with the kids a few years back that set the letters WWJD on there. What would Jesus do? It kind of sounds like an oversimplification, and of course there are a lot of things that Jesus didn't talk about or didn't deal with directly in his lifetime, but nevertheless it kind of speaks to where Christians tend to come from, that he's kind of the core of the faith, and we turn to Jesus when we are trying to make sense out of things. Jesus is our Savior. We see him as the Son of God who incarnated the very presence of God. In other words, Christians believe that in the person of Jesus, God took on human flesh and became subject to all the forces of this world, including human suffering and even death. We believe that Jesus ultimately triumphed over these forces and that he will eventually return to make that triumph complete and to reign over the forces of evil once and for all. Again, the Christian faith has many expressions, and within those many expressions, particular emphases and practices vary. I think particularly in this country, Christianity is a very diverse faith. But Christians share these basic understandings, this core orthodoxy. But more than a set of beliefs and practices, Christians tend to think of their faith in relational terms. And you might hear a Christian talking about being in a relationship with Jesus, or a relationship with other followers of Christ, or other believers of Christ who constitute the church or the community of faith. So as important as our beliefs are and our practices are, it's that sense of relationship and the idea of Jesus being very accessible to us as someone who was born in a peasant class and someone that we can relate to. Is not this daunting figure, but is someone more accessible to us. And so there are a number of hymns that kind of speak to what a friend we have in Jesus, or you know, a number of different ways that Jesus becomes accessible. So out of this summary of Christian belief, I want to lift up two key aspects that are relevant to our conversation today and the two cases. The first is that I briefly mentioned that Jesus' ministry involved healing. That the Gospels present him as moving throughout the countryside and throughout the communities, doing the work of healing, and being soon followed by a number of people who were in need of healing. Jesus healed the blind, the crippled, those with various forms of illness. He seemed to defy convention and even the laws of nature. In doing so, he also delivered the demon-possessed, or we might think of them as mentally ill, from their affliction, and even raise the dead. His acts of healing became his calling card, the way that he signaled that he was someone with the power to transform lives and even the social order. Jesus was in the healing business from the very beginning, and his followers have continued an emphasis on healing from the first century, that immediate group that continued his work on to this century. And so some Christian denominations have done so by building hospitals and being very involved in the healthcare industry. And some other Christian denominations have emphasized faith healing. Now, you might think those are mutually exclusive, but they both grow out of this sense of healing being an important part of Jesus' ministry. And so illness is seen as an enemy that Jesus has the power to overcome. So if you've had a stage 4 cancer diagnosis, or you care about someone who does, this aspect of Jesus' ministry and of the Christian faith can be very attractive. You want a healer. You need a healer. So you want someone like Jesus in your corner. Which reminds me of the mother and son I met when I was doing residency 20 years ago in Indianapolis. The son had cancer, and he was in for a fairly routine kind of visit to the hospital during his stint with cancer. And so as I met them, I was trying to get a feel for what that involved and how they were doing with that. And the mother was as happy as I could imagine a mother with a son with cancer having being, and she was all excited, and she wanted to tell me about having gone to a mass service involving a prominent Christian faith healer of the time. And she told me about how this faith healer had healed her son, or had prayed over him, and she was confident that he was going to overcome this cancer and he was going to be just fine. And at the time, he seemed to be on that kind of trajectory. He had entered into remission. We felt good about that. And so the power of that miracle-working, faith-healing Jesus was very real and very powerful for her. Sometime later, I encountered this mother and son again in the hospital. And he had relapsed. And she was not happy. She was struggling. And in fact, this is before the internet, she was feverishly going through the Yellow Pages looking to find this faith healer. Because she needed another healing. So this is the power of a belief in Jesus and in his ability to heal that can be very compelling for someone who is in crisis. And for those who are maybe dispossessed or displaced, or don't feel like they have access to power within the culture, this image of Jesus and this understanding of him can be especially important and especially appealing. But there's another truth of Jesus' life and ministry that also holds and is relevant, though perhaps somewhat harder to embrace. And that is that Jesus submitted to grief and to suffering, and to death. He wept openly and didn't hide from or try to escape pain. He agonized over his impending crucifixion, to be sure, and in a memorable passage the night before his death, he grieved to the point of sweating drops of blood, the Gospels say. But in the end, he prayed to his Heavenly Father and said, "Not my will, but thine be done." He submitted to suffering and death in order to accomplish a greater good for all humanity. So by facing the cross, he demonstrated how to redeem suffering. He succumbed to death, but we believe he ultimately triumphed over death in order to make forgiveness and resurrection accessible to all. So the Christian hope is not confined strictly to this world and to this temporal reality. We believe that Jesus offers eternal hope, which reaches beyond the limits of this life. So again, if you have a stage 4 cancer diagnosis, this aspect of Jesus' ministry and of the Christian faith also offers hope, but it may not be the one you go to first. It may be the one you come to in the end after you have exhausted all the other options. And I think of an adult cancer patient, which I've been following all this year, who I met the first week of January. She, at the time that I met her, she had had an end-stage diagnosis and was dealing with the fact that she would no longer be able to work. She was grieving a series of losses that her prognosis was bringing to her. But she was, and she's a Christian, and she brings that sense of hope. But she also was dealing with what it means that she wasn't going to get better. And does this mean she's estranged from God because she hasn't been healed in the miracle-working, faith-oriented way? And over time, she has come through her faith to the point where, even though she tried some experimental chemo to try to extend her life and enjoy her time with her family, she has been gradually coming to the reality that this is going to end in her death, and preparing for her death, and doing her last bit of work. And last week she called to tell me that she's decided to do no more chemo, that she has a few weeks to a few months to live, and she's making her peace with that, and tying up loose ends with her family. And that Christian hope of Jesus as one who is with her in her suffering and who can help her to find redemption through her suffering, and hope is also has been very powerful for her. So what does that mean for us when we talk about the issues that we've been dealing with today, and how do we approach families? I think one of the real challenges, and we've touched on this somewhat, is the challenge not to enter into or become part of an adversarial dynamic with families. If you're the doctor and you've just had to tell a patient that they have a poor prognosis or we don't expect them to live very long, many times that patient, and of course we find this especially with younger patients like the ones we're talking about, will resist that notion and they will push back. And they may not be your best friend when you give them that news. And so it can be tempting to feel like you're in an adversarial dynamic that is difficult to overcome. And some, to be honest, some patients and their families turn to the Christian faith in such a situation to leverage power where they feel powerless. And so they may say to a physician who's just given them such a prognosis, well, that's what you say, but God has the last word. Or they may say, I serve a miracle-working God, and I believe that God more than I believe you. So it can be tempting to kind of feel like you're being put on the other side. And it can feel like, as someone who works in a scientific realm, that these ideas of faith are foreign or abstract, and so we don't know quite what to do with it. We may look at a particular patient or family and what they believe and how they practice and think, oh my goodness, they might as well be from another planet. I mean, that honestly, that may be where you feel or where you're coming from. But it's very important not to let yourself get into that kind of an adversarial dynamic. We're all in the healing business. We all want patients and families to get better from their illness. We work together for that. We align ourselves with the family. And by all means, prayer is important. And every aspect of intervention that we can offer, be it clinical and involving chemo to integrative medicine and faith and all those things, can be part of the collection of treatments that we offer a family. And so it's important to respect their faith, not to enter into an adversarial dynamic. Now, you might say, well, you're a chaplain, and so it's easy for you to be aligned with a family. And that is, many times, it is a benefit of the role we play, because they see us as someone who can identify with their faith, can understand that, and often we become companions for them in trying to process information and trying to guide them through what they're going through in their treatment. But I will also say that there are times when patients or families will see a chaplain and will see the end of life and will not want to have anything to do with us. And I'll also say I've experienced that a lot in pediatric cancer, it seems, that a number of families will think if the chaplain's involved, that means my kid is dying, so please don't come anywhere near my child. So it's a challenge for all of us, this dance that we have with children and their families and with adults who are dealing with the difficult diagnoses. I think I may have exhausted my time. I'm not sure if someone's keeping track, but if there are other things, we can talk more about it. Just quickly before I finish, it's the notion of moving from the triumphant Jesus idea to the suffering Jesus, and that transition that many families or many Christian families end up making is not an easy one. And it's many times patients and families feel abandoned by God, feel like God has let them down, or may feel like they've done something wrong to lead to this outcome or to cause God not to heal them or their child. And so that can be a difficult transition. And so a lot of times the role that I feel like we play as chaplains is really to embody the divine and to come along and companion them and reassure them that they haven't been forgotten and to really care about them through the process and represent that Jesus who suffers with them and is with them in their pain. I want to say a word to all of us. We have an ethical obligation not to abandon patients and these families. They may be foreign to us in terms of socioeconomic class or religious background or level of education or whatever it may be. We may think of them as the other. We may see their situation, what they're dealing with, and not even want to touch it. But we have an ethical obligation not to abandon them, to enter in with them and help them through it. And so while that may, again, take a lot of humility and a lot of courage, I encourage you not to abandon them, to have to rise to the challenge and to enter in with them. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me? I also want to thank Anita and Rabbi Silber for inviting me to be with you all today and just talk a little bit about the Islamic tradition and talk about a little bit of the work I do as a chaplain at Johns Hopkins. I first want to say that Islam is under the umbrella of the Abrahamic faith, along with Christianity and Judaism, so I feel very comfortable here between my brothers. I feel very comfortable. And I just wanted to say that what we do as far as visiting people who are sick or suffering is considered sacred in the Islamic tradition. There is a tradition from the Prophet where he says that for every footstep that we take walking towards someone who's sick or suffering, God is showering us with mercy. And that mercy stays upon us until while we're sitting there and until we leave. So for me as a chaplain, that speaks to my heart. It speaks to the love of God for those who are challenged with illness or facing death. There's another tradition that is very similar to coming out of the book of Matthew where the divine says, I was sick and you visited me. We have in the Islamic tradition where the prophet said that God Almighty will say to a servant, I was sick and you didn't visit me. And the servant will say, how could I visit you? You are the Lord of all the worlds. How could I have visited you? And then he says, if you would have visited David, you would have found me there with him. So in the Islamic tradition, we see God with the suffering. We see God in the room with us when we go to visit someone who's sick in those ICU rooms, on those units of the hospital. So again, it's a sacred space for us. I just want to say this, that I'm speaking from my experience, being born and raised Muslim, coming from Southern California, being raised in an interfaith family. So my views are maybe slightly different if you asked someone else who's Muslim, maybe from another country or another part of the world. So again, I'm speaking from my own experience. And my experience was my mother was Christian and my father was Muslim. And my Islamic tradition came from my father's grandmother. She was a Pakistani Muslim woman, married my grandfather, who converted to Islam. He was African American, and then they raised all their children Muslim, and they all married Christians. So, yes. And so when I was born, the third of my parents' children, I was born into an interfaith environment, which I love. So we celebrated Ramadan and Christmas and Easter and Eid al-Adha, so I got toys all the time. And I just thought everybody lived this way, and it was just such a gift that I got to live and experience the best of both worlds. I learned about Christ and the loving example he is from my mom, and I learned about Islam from my father. So fast forward now, as a chaplain, I feel like I was birthed into interfaith, and the other part of that is most of the time I see people who are not Muslim. We have a small census of Muslim patients that I do see, but the majority of my visits are with non-Muslim. So let me say that in the Islamic tradition, the human life, the human condition is looked at with great respect. The human life has inherent value. It doesn't matter what race, it doesn't matter what gender, it doesn't matter where you come from. But we have an idea that every life is valuable. Islam emphasizes preserving life. So in a healthcare environment, we preserve life. We want to promote restoring health, alleviating suffering. We want to respect patients' autonomy and do medical justice. We want to be honest with patients and tell them the truth about their condition and do no further harm. And while Islam does give the importance to preserving life and saving life, we also have a great respect for death. We're taught in the Quran that death is inevitable, and we don't know the time that our death will come. So for a Muslim, our hope and our prayers often, when we're struggling with seeing a loved one die, is, oh my goodness, I hope this isn't their time, I'm going to miss them. But we do know that inevitably the death is going to come, and we don't know when. Quality of life in the Islamic tradition is just as equal as a lifespan, but we know that the value of not promoting further harm to someone, there's a point where we can make different decisions. And we have, from the Islamic tradition, the Sharia law, which actually the Arabic word Sharia means a path to what's good and ethical. Although in the media it sounds like something totally different. The actual word means a path to find what is best, what is good, and what is ethical. And the Sharia law is drawn from the two Islamic tradition, the sacred texts, the Quran, which is the holy book that Muslims follow, which was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, and then the traditions of the Prophet's life, how he was as a husband, as a father, as a statesman, businessman, and so forth. So the practice of the Islamic community looks at the Sharia law, we look at the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet to make decisions about healthcare and end-of-life decisions. So let me just point out some key points about the Sharia law that's related to healthcare. So we have a principle that necessity overrides a prohibition. So an example would be, I'm somewhere, and in my Islamic tradition, I'm not allowed to eat pork. If I find myself in a situation where that is all that I have, and if I don't eat the pork, I will starve to death, then I am able to eat the pork. So in with that thinking, we bring that into healthcare, and we think about something that might be thought about as prohibited. We will embrace that. For example, if accept the lesser of harm if they cannot be avoided. For example, my mother's youngest sister was diagnosed with cancer, and she was in a lot of pain. And the doctors told her if we gave her the pain medication, it could hasten her death. As Muslims, we know we cannot let her suffer, so we had to make a decision on her behalf because she was not able to cognitively speak on her, you know, for herself. So we decided that we wanted her to have the pain medication so she would not suffer. And she did die shortly after getting the medication, but in our heart, that was the right thing to do according to the Sharia. Also, another key point from the Sharia is that harm should be removed. A point would be in a healthcare environment is removing anything that is causing additional harm. That would be chest compressions if it's not going to help someone, removing someone from a respirator if it's not helping at that point, that we're able to make a different decision if we find that the interventions are causing more harm than good. And then there's another value, ethical value, of public interest overriding an individual interest. Now how that might play out is if there's someone in an ICU room taking up resources and the treatments are futile and we're moving in that direction, then you can make a different, we can make different decisions about freeing up that space for someone else who may need it. So the Sharia brings in critical thinking about how we can make decisions that are in accordance to the Islamic law and that families can feel somewhat reassured in their grief that they're making the right decisions. One thing that the Sharia does say is that although we can make different decisions about end-of-life interventions, there are some things that we don't take away. We don't take away nutrition. We don't take away care. It's just that we make different decisions when we know that the care is going to be futile. So I just wanted to highlight some of the ethical values in healthcare, and this is just general. So excuse me if I repeat some of them, because some of them are rooted in Sharia. But one is seeking medical treatment in the Islamic tradition is mandatory. There's a saying from the Prophet that for every disease here on earth that God has created a cure. We don't know when that cure will be discovered, but there is a cure. So in the case study where there was experimentation and trying different things to try to save a life, that is allowed. Again, when it gets to a point where the interventions are being harmful, then you can make a different decision. Where our bodies are considered a trust, a sacred trust from God, and so we are to care for them, keep our bodies as healthy as possible, and we know in the end that our bodies, our trust will return to the divine. Our children, I was thinking about the Pete's case, our children are considered a trust as well. So we have, when a child cannot advocate for themselves, then we as parents advocate on their behalf. So making decisions about what's best. And when I was looking at the case about, I think it was Ellie, the young girl, and although she's a young girl, there's a concept in Islam and in the ethical, there's an ethical value of being merciful. Every chapter of the Quran except one starts, "In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful." And the Prophet said that, "Be merciful and gracious to those on earth as the God in heaven is merciful to you." So in a case where perhaps this child is suffering and doesn't want to continue, the family can think about how can they be merciful to the child and respect the child's wishes and make decisions based on that. We have a reverence for the sacred nature of the body because we believe that the divine puts the spirit of God within the child when the child is still in the mother's uterus. At about four months, we're taught that God puts God's breath into the individual or the baby, and that's when actual real life starts. So there's a sacredness about when I meet David that it's one soul meeting another. Or if I meet the rabbi, it's one soul meeting another. And that's sacred. So we do everything we can to maintain life and maintain that spirit. Another point I want to make, the idea of caring for the sick is a responsibility that we look at in a greater picture. We look at it as a responsibility of not just the family, but the community. So we have, similar to what I started off with, that this idea that people will come and be supportive and pray and join families when they're suffering. There's also this idea that I'm just going to use organ donation. There's a saying in the Quran where if you save one life, it's as if you saved all of humanity. So with organ donation, just to use that as an example, the community has an investment in the saving lives of others. And one other, let's see. And I wanted to touch on, I love when you were talking about Christ and how he displayed his grief. Although Muslims, we know that death is inevitable and we will lose loved ones in the ICU units and that we do all we can to save life and we also respect death. Once we are aware that we have to say goodbye, there's certain things that we try to do. For example, if someone's dying, we will want the person to hear recitation of the Quran. When a baby's born, the first thing we do is recite in the baby's ear. So when someone's dying, we want the last thing for them to hear is recitation from the Holy Scripture. The Prophet, when he lost his son Ibrahim, he was grieving and crying, and his companions looked at him and said, "Oh my God, you're a prophet of God and you're crying? You get this. This is death. You get this." And the Prophet said, "Yes." He said, "But our hearts break, and God knows that, and tears are a mercy. They're a way God lets us express our grief." So I remember when I trained at another hospital before I came here, one of the labor and delivery chaplains came to me and she said, "I know all about your tradition. Muslim women don't cry when they lose babies." And I know. I said, "Where'd you hear that?" She said, "Well, someone told me that." I said, "No, grief and loss is something that God honors." And the Prophet was a beautiful example of that when he lost his son. So we are allowed to grieve, and we still hold to the idea that we know that death is part of life. And then a couple things I just wanted to say. I have done work and research and travel to the Middle East with the Islamic Medical Association of North America. They're a group here in the States, and they do a lot of research. And I'm just going to give you a couple points that they've highlighted that I hold to in my work. One, that advanced directives are recommended for Muslim families. Imana promotes that, promotes DNR, DNI orders. And Imana also has ruled that brain death is a legitimate form of death. There are parts of the Muslim world where perhaps those discussions are still going on. Is brain death a legitimate cause of death? So Islamic Medical Association here in North America has said brain death is truly death. Let's see, am I about right time? Okay, I think I'll save the rest of this if there's some questions, but thank you very much.
afternoon, everyone. So first, I just want to say what a privilege it is to sit on this panel with David and Tara. And wouldn't it be wonderful if our three religions could collaborate throughout the world as beautifully as we're collaborating today? I say there's hope if Hopkins physicians could speak at a University of Maryland event. And perhaps Judaism, Islam, and Christianity could coexist as well. You know, David began by saying that he was speaking on behalf of Christendom. I'm really impressed. I am not speaking on behalf of the Jewish people. Because really, as Tara mentioned, within our religion, there are many different streams, many different movements, and each of those streams and their movements have their own sets of ideas, ideals, principles, really in all areas of Judaic life, but certainly in end-of-life care as well. I am a congregational rabbi. I'm not an official chaplain. I'm a congregational rabbi, thank God, of a large synagogue not far from here. And a good part of my rabbinic responsibilities really focus around pastoral care. So I certainly spend a significant amount of time in hospitals and nursing homes. And very often in the Jewish tradition, when a family has a question about end-of-life care, interestingly enough, they'll often call the rabbi even before the doctor. Again, it's really focusing on the Orthodox community, because within Orthodoxy, very often people will want to know first what Jewish law says about their decisions. And afterwards, sometimes much to the irritation of the doctors, then the families will call the doctors afterwards. So just a little bit of background, because my co-panelists, I thought, did such a beautiful job on giving a little bit of background to their religion. So just to give you just a brief soundbite about Judaism. So Judaism, of course, we look to the Bible. And when we refer to the Bible, we refer to the five books of the Old Testament, what we call the Torah. But we also believe, now, as one knows, if one has studied the Bible, so one knows, and I believe this is true in all faiths, that there are certain verses that when you read them, they're not meant to be understood literally. For example, so the Torah says, the Bible says, an eye for an eye. So, for example, we have what's called an oral tradition. We believe that when Moses received the Torah at Mount Sinai thousands of years ago, that God did not just simply give him what we call the written law, but gave him an oral tradition. That oral tradition teaches us how to properly decode and understand the written law. So if you want to get an idea of Judaism, reading the Old Testament, the truth is, does not really give you a full understanding. You'd have to read the Old Testament and then supplemental legal commentaries as well that we call the Mishnah, we call the Talmud. And just to show you how incredible this is, one of the greatest arbiters of Jewish law, probably in the last century, was a man by the name of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. And Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was most well known because he ruled on a number of medical ethics issues. He ruled on everything from the definition of death, removal of life support. And the amazing part is that where did he glean his answers from? Every single one of his answers originated with scripture in the Old Testament, passage from the Talmud, and then all of the commentaries going down throughout all of the generations. So every decision we make in a Judaic construct, in a Judaic framework, has its origins within our Torah, both our written and our oral traditions. There's a lot more to be said about that, but we'll save that for a different time. I think if I had to kind of summarize the ethos of Judaism, I would use the following example. I would say that it's really, Judaism is all about balancing hope and reality. I'll give you a simple example. So every year we celebrate Passover. And of course, one of the most important parts of Passover observance is the Seder. So we gather together, hopefully with family and friends, and really in an effort to go ahead and retell and recall the events of when we were once upon a time slaves in Egypt, and God redeemed us 3,000 years ago. And we recall that event really as a springboard for our own personal emancipation from our difficulties and struggles as well. And there's an amazing phrase in the Haggadah. The Haggadah, for lack of a better term, it's like the playbook for the Seder. It tells you what to do, when to do, how to do it. And there's an amazing statement in there. It says, Hashata avdi L'shana haba b'nei chorin. This year we are slaves, we are servants. Next year we'll be free. Now, of course, the Haggadah is not just simply referring to physical servitude. We're all slaves to something. We're all shackled to something. And so we pray, almost in an anticipatory tone, that this year maybe we're shackled to something, but hopefully next year we'll experience redemption. And I often thought to myself, why do we say, if I'm shackled to something, so now this year I'm a slave, this year I'm a servant, next year I'll be free. Why don't I say what? What? Good morning. Hello. Good. Hey, why don't I say, again, now I'm in servitude, now I'm shackled, tomorrow, next week, why next year? Because the idea is we believe in Judaism that although miracles can happen, and although life can change on a dime, more often than not, change is gradual. More often than not, things take time. More often than not, the truth is God is not going to part the seas before you and show you the way to go through. You're going to have to figure it out. You're going to have to navigate the difficulties and the complexities of the human condition. Again, do miracles occur? They occur every single day. We call them nature. We call them science. That they occur each and every day. But Judaism represents this beautiful balance between, on one hand, hope. I know one day I'll be freed from all those things that ensnare and shackle me. But again, reality, it's probably not going to be today. It's probably not going to be tomorrow. It'll probably take a little bit of time. Just a couple of other things in terms of, you know, as I think it was Marilyn McPherson said, and I'm going to really remember this line where she said, sometimes Jesus needs a chemical assist. I think it should be a bumper sticker. But in Judaism, of course, we don't believe in Jesus as the Messiah, but we would just substitute God. We would say, God needs a chemical assist. In Judaism, we believe the Hebrew word is hishtadlus. Hishtadlus means effort. Effort. So for example, if somebody calls me and asks me my opinion about a particular medical reality or a particular question, the first thing I will always tell them is, did you speak to the doctor? I'm honored that you're calling me. I'm wonderful, thank you. But at the end of the day, I am not going to be your path to salvation. I cannot be your first responder. You have to seek out normative, responsible advice. Hishtadlus. You have to put in your effort. But the amazing part about Judaism is, it's not an either or. We believe that a person has to put in all human effort possible, and we'll define what all human effort actually means. A person has to put in an incredible amount of hishtadlus, of effort, but at the same time, a person, we believe that each and every day, God is guiding us. We believe that, you know, there's a beautiful, one of the Hasidic masters was a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Aberdichev. And Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Aberdichev said that, you know, one of the things that we celebrate as a people was mass revelation at Mount Sinai, where God appeared to us and he spoke out the Ten Commandments. And this great rabbi explained that if you strain your ear enough, you can still hear the voice of God giving those commandments. Because we believe, as my co-panelist said as well, that God envelops us at every moment, that his arm is around us, he's always holding our hand, he's always kissing our forehead, he's always taking care of us, he's always looking out for us. And even if we can't see him, even if we can't identify him, even if we can't actively point and say, there's where he is, we believe he's there. So we have this beautiful synergistic partnership between, on one hand, putting in every ounce of effort possible, while at the same time believing that if we do our part, God will do his. Interestingly enough, so there are so many things that I want to share with you today, but because of time, I'm going to try to keep it short. One of the things I've come to learn, and it really is an incredible value in Judaism, is you can't fix every situation. It's arrogant to think that you could find a solution. It's arrogant to think that there's a cure for everything. It's maybe at some point in time the cures will be revealed. But right now it's arrogant to think that I can do everything in my power to ameliorate the difficulty or suffering of another. So what do you do when you're faced with a situation where someone has a debilitating illness from which medical science is there's no recovery? Can miracles happen? Absolutely. But barring miracles, what should be done? So Judaism teaches us that the only thing worse than suffering is suffering alone. that we believe that the best thing you could do for someone who's having a difficult time in life, and of course, our topic today is medical ethics, but this is not limited to a cancer patient or to a brain tumor patient. This is true of anyone who is experiencing difficulties in life. The greatest thing you could ever do for another individual is to let them know that you are there for them. I can't tell you how many times I've sat with families, and you know, we live in an age where we're very awkward with silence. Right? So thank God for handheld devices. Because this way, if you're in the elevator, God forbid you should strike up a conversation, you could always look down and at least pretend you're texting. Right? Something. We're so uneasy with silence, but sometimes there's nothing to be said. Sometimes, you know, we have a law. We have one of the rules we have is that when a person loses a loved one, there's a period of shiva, of 7 days, where the family sits and mourns. And the Shulchan Aruch, which is our code of law, says that when you go to visit a mourner, the visitor is not permitted to initiate conversation with the mourner. It is the mourner who must begin the dialogue. Because the rabbis understood that sometimes people don't feel like talking. Sometimes people don't want to converse, and sometimes what I have to say isn't going to make all that much of a difference. So you'll say to yourself, well, what's the point of visiting if there's no dialogue? And the answer is one word, companionship. Because you recognize that sometimes just being there for the other, makes all the difference in the world. And I would venture to say, and I don't know if the physicians or social workers or nurses would agree, but I think that the difference between a good doctor and a great doctor is not necessarily the amount of knowledge they possess, but it's how much time they spend in the patient's room after going ahead and delivering the diagnosis. It's the fact that someone takes... I want to tell you an amazing story. About 9 years ago, I had a teenage boy from my congregation who was having terrible headaches, went to the local ER, and was quickly seen to have had a brain tumor. So they sent him to another area hospital. And I'm sorry, that's the story. I'm going to tell you. They sent him, and the reason it was Dr. Brem was here on the morning panel, they sent him to Hopkins, and Dr. Brem once made the mistake a long time ago of giving me his cell phone number. So as soon as I met the family at the ER, I called Dr. Brem, and Dr. Brem got on the phone with the family, spent 10 minutes on the phone with the family. And after he got off the phone, the father of the child turned to me and he said, wow, that is a great doctor. I said to him, what did Dr. Brem tell you? He said, I have no idea. So then I quickly understood, why was the father of this child saying that Dr. Brem was a great doctor? Because it was 10:30 at night, and I got a hold of the chief of neurosurgery on his cell phone, and he answered, and he took the time to talk with the patient. And he took the time to be there with them. This is a core Jewish value. Sometimes we're too busy to appreciate it. Sometimes we think that we just have to get in and get out, accomplish and withdraw. But the idea ultimately is in Judaism that we recognize the power of companionship. That sometimes, even if I can't do anything to cure the disease, even if I can't do anything to actively ameliorate the difficulties or suffering, the knowledge that the person in a compromised circumstances knows that I am there is incredibly powerful, impactful, and spiritually and emotionally restorative and rejuvenating. We also don't believe that you have to do everything in every situation. This is a commonly misheld belief, and I think you've heard this from my co-panelists as well. I think people often misunderstand religion in general, that religion requires you to do anything and everything to sustain and prolong life. Each of our religions clearly places an emphasis on life. Judaism values, again, Tyra mentioned a beautiful adage that we have in our tradition as well. Kol hamakayim nefesh achas miyisrael kiyim kol olam malei. If you sustain one life, it's as if you sustain the entire world. And by extension, cutting short a life is tantamount to bloodshed within our tradition. No different than, God forbid, actively murdering someone. That being said, we recognize that there are circumstances in which prolonging of life will not serve the interests or the benefit of the patient. I can't really, before you today, tell you when and how that's true, because in our faith tradition, each and every case is reckoned differently. Each and every case is judged on its own merit. Each and every case is understood based on who the patient is, what their circumstances are, very often taking into account the sensitivities of the family as well. Some of the major issues that come up within our faith tradition is I encourage all of my congregants to sign what's called a halachic living will. Halacha is the Hebrew term for Jewish law. So there is a document that says that a person takes with them to the hospital that's on file that says, I am an Orthodox Jew, and therefore I want all of my end-of-life decisions made in conformance with Jewish law. That document often identifies a family member who is empowered to help facilitate those decisions, and that document will list two rabbis, if you could find two rabbis that you like. Okay? If you can find two rabbis that you like, then you can place that on, and that goes with the patient wherever they go. And therefore, again, when the end of life issues come up, the rabbi, of course, has to be accessible, available, and ready to answer those questions. The major tensions that come up, that I've had come up with situations that I've been involved in, and I want to be conscious of the time as well, often come up with the removal of life support. And that's because within Judaism, within halachic Judaism, within Jewish law, there is a major debate as to the definition of death. The predominant opinion, and within the Orthodox community, the majority opinion, is still that cardiac death is the end of life. The absence of spontaneous respiration or brainstem death is an opinion held within the Orthodox community, but it is still a minority opinion. Of course, this has ramifications in many ways. This has ramifications, of course, for actively withdrawing life support, extubating a patient who is on life support, and of course, it has major ramifications for organ donation as well. So it's just important, again, that the healthcare provider be sensitive to these realities. So it's often not enough just to know that a person is Jewish, but really the healthcare providers have to plumb the depths a little bit more to understand the true nature of one's Jewish sensitivities as they vary from community to community and really from stream to stream. Another interesting thing that we have, and really as Tara and David both mentioned, is going back to that balancing between hope and reality, that on one hand, we're an optimistic people. And that's the reason we're still here after 3,000 years of difficulties. We are an optimistic people. But at the same time, again, we don't wear blinders. So if a person is ill and it's clear that a person is going to die, we keep the flame of hope alive a little bit. You know, one of the great rabbis who lived in Israel before the founding of the state was a man by the name of Rabbi Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. And Rabbi Cook was once speaking to a group of physicians at Hadassah Hospital. And he said to the physicians, you're never allowed to tell a patient that there's no hope. Never allowed to say such a thing like that. So you would expect that as a rabbi he was going to say because God could provide miracles. That's not what he said. He said because you never know what breakthrough medical science is going to have today. You never know what's coming down the pike, what's on the horizon. So we never tell a person there's no hope. But at the same time, we don't wear blinders and we prepare people for the journey that is ahead. How do we prepare in Judaism for death? So there's a very beautiful process called vidui. Vidui means confession. You know, in life, even if a person has led a very good life, there are always things that we did that we wish we didn't do, things that we said that we wish we didn't say. And so vidui is an opportunity to cleanse oneself. Vidui is an opportunity to first say, I'm sorry to God. I'm sorry for what I've done. I'm human. I'm frail. I made mistakes. I tried my best. I know at times I fell short, but I'm taking now in these last moments of life to say I'm sorry. The second part is asking forgiveness from friends and family. You know, the amazing part about the nature of the human condition is we might be from different religions and different walks of life, but all of us at some time over the course of life had some type of frayed or strained relationships. And it is so important for a person to be able to die peacefully, to know that they have brought closure to those difficult and strained relationships. It is so important for them to say, I'm sorry to someone who they hurt, and it is so important for others who may have hurt the dying individual to come and say, I'm sorry as well. Vidui, and vidui itself is very, very sensitive, because as David said, you know, sometimes the rabbi comes in and says, hey, let's do vidui. That's certainly not going to work, right? Because, again, so obviously, on one hand, you want to keep the hope alive, but at the same time, you want to prepare a person for all possibilities and eventualities. Many of the other questions that come up, we spoke about, as we just mentioned before, removal from life support, putting in a feeding tube. Putting in a feeding tube also, people make mistakes based on religion all the time, thinking that religion always mandates it. Not true. There are sometimes where a feeding tube should be put in, where if you give a person this type of nutrition, you can nurse them back to health. Absolutely, Judaism would advocate for it. But if all it is doing is perpetuating a situation that you know is going to end in the death of the patient, then there is not an obligation. It doesn't mean the patient can't exercise their rights. Every person has individual rights to do what they love with their life, to extend their life as they want, but it wouldn't necessarily be a halachic mandate. The other piece to just mention is postmortem care. That in Judaism, so care of another Jew does not just extend during life, but it extends during death as well. And this is very important because often this postmortem care has an impact upon the hospital and healthcare facility. For example, that we believe that when a person passes away, we try to move the body as little as possible. And we also always want someone else to be with the body, because we believe in the Jewish tradition that when a person dies, see, people often think that you die and your soul ascends to heaven. In Jewish tradition, we believe that when a person dies, the soul hovers over the body at the moment of death. The soul remains with the body until the time of burial. And then again, during the Shiva period, the soul shuttles back and forth between the house of mourning and between the cemetery. It's only 30 days after death that the soul begins its journey to the celestial sphere. So we believe that the soul of our loved one is there, and therefore, it's not that we don't want to leave the body alone. We don't want to leave the soul alone. And this is very important, because very often a hospital or a nursing facility will want to move the body to a morgue, which is very problematic from a Jewish tradition perspective. We try, of course, to always be respectful to the hospital nursing facility and try to facilitate the removal of the body by the funeral home as quickly as possible. But very often the Jewish patient will ask for the understanding of the hospital to please allow the loved one to remain in place until, again, the funeral home is able to come and retrieve the person. We also wrap the body after death. Again, a more complex cleansing and washing is done later on, but we take off the bed sheets from the edge of the bed and wrap the body. All of this is done in order to preserve the dignity of the deceased. We close the eyes of the deceased to the best of our ability. We close the mouth of the deceased, because even though we believe in the soul, the eternality of the soul, and the fact that the soul is the dominant part of who and what we are, that body was the case, was the physical case that housed that soul. And because of that, that body is holy as well, and therefore, we want to treat it with the utmost respect as well. And one last thing with this I'll end, is, and both David and Tara mentioned this as well, that one of the things I always try to help people grapple with is that the righteous do suffer. Very often when a person is afflicted by illness, the natural, reflexive, almost introspective way to think about things is, what did I do wrong? Why did I deserve this? What is it? Where did I make a wrong turn in life that God has visited this upon me? And it's so important from a Jewish perspective to always instill within the individual. We have a long tradition of wonderful people who did everything right suffering. Not because God is a mean or vengeful God. God forbid, we believe that God is a loving, embracing. He's a father to us. He's not a king. He's not a master. He's not someone who wants to subdue us. He's someone who loves us and wants to nurture us. But we also, as both David and Tara said, we're humble enough to know that we don't understand the divine will. That we don't understand ultimately why God does certain things. And there are some times in life where we have difficulties, we find ourselves in the midst of difficult circumstances because of things that we have to learn about ourselves, because of strengths and abilities we have to develop within. And sometimes God visits certain circumstances upon certain people so that those around them could learn and grow as well. But we try to reinforce this. I never try to be the prophet of God, because I'm not. And I never try to intuit what the divine will is, because I have absolutely no idea. But by simply being there, by being present, by providing companionship, by holding their hand, by letting them know that I will be by their side from the beginning to the end, whatever that end is, The hope is that we can bring a little bit of comfort, a little bit of care, even in the most difficult of situations. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sure you will agree that that was an extremely enlightening panel.